Hello, my name is John Smetanka, and the name of our program is With Respect. Today's guest on With Respect is Bill Hurst. Bill is the author of a fascinating book called Our Great Political Divide, talking about the causes and the impacts and prospects of the fact that we are somewhat of a divided nation in many different respects. So, we're going to be talking in With Respect today with Bill Hurst. How are you today?
I'm doing well, John. I really appreciate this invite to your show on such an important topic.
Tell me, where are you from originally?
Originally, I grew up in New York. Then I attended school in Williamstown, Massachusetts at Williams College. And then I went to Northwestern University for business school and then settled in the Midwest in Chicago and in Michigan.
How long have you been in Michigan?
Been in Michigan as a vacationer in Union Pier since the late 80s. And then in 2005, my wife and I moved inland to a farm and in Baroda, Michigan, which has a mix of rural people and some people from Chicago. And we know a lot of people from Chicago and other areas of our area of Michigan and Southwest Michigan. But since 2005, we've lived here full time.
What's your educational background? What kind of work do you do?
Well, it's really interesting you ask. I mean, what I do for what I've done for a living, and I've just retired about a month ago, is I was in IT as a consultant for large companies, startups, et cetera. I worked at Blue Cross Blue Shield implementing the new healthcare law and a strategic implementation. I've worked at Meijer most recently for about 6 or 7 years, but I've retired from there. And really, if you don't mind my telling folks how I even came to this topic, I'm a lifelong reader, you know, of current events, philosophy, history, et cetera. And I majored in economics at college and finance at business school. And I just became alarmed in 2015, 2016, as I saw our politics taking this populist turn. And I was just concerned about why it was occurring and wanted to understand it better.
How did you go about doing that? I mean, everybody's got a view of our problems. But I always want to see, how did they come upon it? Because the platform from which you see a problem also helps to define it in your mind, and your platform may be different than other people.
Well, John, that's a really good observation. And the way I started out was, besides doing some reading, I started out interviewing neighbors. And, you know, it started as I saw Jill and Mark come up our driveway with Trump signs, and I wanted to understand why they, you know, were supporting Donald Trump. As I talked to neighbors from Chicago who tended to be more liberal as to why they thought we should open our borders or do some things that I, you know, really needed to understand a lot better. But then as I started with neighbors, I really felt that I needed to dive into the literature. And I did a really deep dive into the literature of our politics, our polarization, et cetera, going back into historical texts, going to political science texts to really understand how we got here in the first place.
What were your first conclusions, if you, because, you know, every book or every philosophy starts someplace from a perspective, from a perception of what reality is, and then it develops. And so, as you learn, like it's a human process. You learn, and every time you learn a new bit of knowledge, it affects you in your original perception. Could even turn it around and change the perception, change the way you look at things. How about you?
You know, that's so true. When I started out, and by the way, I keep on learning now. You know, having written the book and moving on to, you know, how do we move out of our polarization? But when I first started, I went towards the explanation that lots of folks were going to, which was that this was a class economic problem, that there were folks who were left behind. And I took sort of an economic stance, and it shows up in my early interview with Neighbors, where I really didn't understand what they were telling me. And so that's why, as I heard my neighbors talk, I realized I needed to grow and figure out where are they really coming from? Because I didn't see any systematic conversation about being left behind, about economics, et cetera. I heard more about resentment, suspicion, et cetera, things they didn't like. And so I really needed to understand what are the roots of that.
Where did you first get your first aha moment? You talked about this fellow and his wife coming up with Trump signs or clothes or whatever. Was that a big shock? And if it was, what did it do to you?
Well, you know, I have to let you know a little bit about my own biases. So, you know, politically, I'm very much a centrist. I guess in parlance of ideology, some people would call me maybe what used to be a blue dog Democrat, you know, fiscally conservative, you know, somewhat conservative in temperament, but believing in Keynesian economics, you know, the welfare state, safety nets, et cetera. And so as I heard my neighbors talk about, you know, all of our money is going to these particular neighbors, all of our money is going to people overseas. And I heard them support the rhetoric of Donald Trump, whose rhetoric I had trouble with as he came down that elevator, talked about Mexicans being rapists, et cetera. I really just felt that I needed to, you know, understand them better. But my aha moment didn't come from understanding them. It came from not understanding them. And then reading some books about identity politics. So I can just mention a few sources. I mean, one source I read was a guy, Francis Fukuyama, who wrote a book about it, identity and the demand for dignity, and talked about how did identity politics even come about, both on the left and the right, and the differences. And understanding those differences allowed me to understand the people I was talking to much better. And that, so it came from a melding of the things I was reading, plus more sophisticated approaches to the conversations I was having with neighbors. My questions got better. I baselined neighbors, you know, politically, using a Pew Research poll that enables people to be placed on an ideological spectrum. And my questions were much more about probing what people believed and thought and why in light of those theories about identity.
Now, everybody has an identity, whether they know it or not. That is, those accumulations of character traits that they think that they have. I am a male. I am an American. I am from the Midwest. I am a former baseball pitcher. I am interested in history. I am all these things. And they all make a part of me. And so I don't think about those things when I start talking to you. I have to reflect on them. And I have to say, ooh, just what I just said. I said something which shows that I'm from the Midwest. So what are those factors that you have come up with that on both sides of this divide that we are viewing unpleasantly every day? What are those factors that give the identity, well, I don't know what the phrase you're going to use is, identity politics, gives it the specifics that have people on both sides? What are they?
Yeah, so, you know, the book follows some deep history, and I think one of the things that the book really talks about is how deep some of these fractures are. But one of the unique things in America right now, in terms of how voters are polarized, so parties are polarized, and that happened from the civil rights movement on through Reagan and beyond, and you can trace it into the Tea Party and Trump. But then voters also polarized, and along a whole set of dimensions where Democrats, you know, and I'm generalizing, but it really does describe a lot of the, you know, the fault lines. So conservatives tend to be a little more place-based. Liberals are cosmopolitan, people who believe in globalism, who believe in people finding their own identity as they grow up. Conservatives believe that identity comes from family, religion, patriotism, country, nationalism, etc. There's that urban-rural divide where liberals tend to be urban, and conservatives tend to be more tend to live in rural areas, secular versus religion. What media people listen to, you know, and I've had so many conservatives say, "I need my Fox, you know, my Fox News." That is the giant in the conservative arena. Liberals have a more diverse set of news sources. And polls have shown now that I belong to a group where we listen to an analysis of an Ipsos poll that says that for Democrats and Republicans, party now is such an incredibly strong sense of identity. But it also mirrors those other lines I just talked about. And then identity becomes stacked. And when you lose an election, all of those multiple dimensions of identity are emotionally stacked together so that you feel like every election you win is a tremendous win, and every one you lose is an existential loss for you.
One of the things that I've heard over and over again from all parties, not just Democrats and Republicans, is, ladies and gentlemen, this is the most important election in this century, in our lifetime. And it's all ginning up people to really pay attention and to get out there and motivate people and vote and all that. But we say that so often that it loses its punch, doesn't it?
Yeah, so folks in politics now know that winning and losing is emotional, and that grows out of group dynamics as we've split along these fault lines. We're part of Team A and Team B, Republicans and Democrats, and every election or even insults to the other side, and a lot of our partisanship now is negative, disliking the other side. It's not even so much that we've grown to like our own party more, it's that we've grown to dislike the other side. And so in every election, you need to get turnout. It's about negative turnout, you know, turnout because of negative factors often. And so saying you're going to win, winning is a big, you know, motivator for people, and losing is a downer. Anxiety prevents people from acting. And so when people lose elections, what they do is they figure out, how can we generate anger? You know, because anger now is, you know, in terms of group dynamics, is the way to get people away from their sadness at losing and motivated to do something new for their party, like the Tea Party, for example.
Well, you know, I'm going to challenge you on one point. Something that I've been looking at, I read a series of books by Lynn Olson. She's been a guest in our show, and she's talked about in her books about the time between 1936 and 1945 in Europe and the United States coming into the Second World War. I was not alive in the 30s. However, My dad had to go to the Army, and I do remember him coming home from Europe after the war in the from the Army. So I have some memory, but I also have read a lot about the Second World War and some about the First World War, a lot about the Civil War, a lot about the Revolutionary War. And one of the things that has struck me is that if we think that the language used to demonize the other side in a political debate today is strong, they ought to look at the election of 1932 1936 when the storm clouds were gathering for the Second World War, and there was the America First movement personified by perhaps by Charles Lindbergh, and then the other side personified perhaps by Franklin Roosevelt. And the language that they used, calling each other traitors and treasonous behavior and much worse than that, language you can't even use in a talk show today. That was existent then. Back in the Civil War, there was violent language, violent activity. There was parades and burning people in effigy. And you go back to the Revolutionary War, and the same thing seems to happen when those great events are going on. People polarize. So why is it so different now from those days?
Well, that's a great question. And, you know, polarization has been around in the United States. And one of the points of my book is to go through the history of how the fracture occurred. And one of the fractures is along the lines of civil rights legislation, where we had, at the time that of the New Deal coalition, which lasted, certainly through Johnson and beyond, Lyndon Johnson and beyond, we had two parties that some people call four parties under the hood. You know, we had Democrats in the South who were very conservative. We had Democrats in the North who were liberal, more conservative and liberal Republicans from the West and the North. You know, and yes, there's certainly, especially in regard to World War II and being involved or not being involved, Americans have fought hard about issues like that. And, you know, polarizing language has certainly been part of our country. I think the issue now is that we don't have the consensus that unites us, that united us during the New Deal. Essentially, the two parties are completely split apart. There are no points of consensus. During the 30s and 40s, there were a number of points of consensus on the economic policies of Roosevelt as they began to succeed.
We're going to talk more about this as after our break, but right now we're talking to Bill Hurst, the author of Our Great Political Divide, talking about how Americans are split these days by all different kinds of criteria, I won't even say warring camps, I'll just say camps and stacks and whatnot. This is John Smetanka on With Respect, and we will be right back. Now back on With Respect with Bill Hurst, the author of Our Great Political Divide, talking about America in the 2100s, 2021, etc., and how we got this way, and maybe later on we'll talk a little bit about how do we get out of it, if we want to. This is John Smetanka. So, Bill, when we broke, you started talking about the civil rights movement, for an example, and the coalition that Roosevelt and the Democrats put together in the 1930s, which lasted a long time. And the party that was personified that was the Democratic Party.
ironically, the same Democratic Party that back in the Civil War had been in favor of slavery and anti-popular thinking. But at any rate, it is a different Democratic Party, and it's a different Republican Party. But so, tease out some more of what you're talking about in these various issues.
Sure. So let's just talk about how the New Deal coalition broke down. So as I mentioned before the break, people talked about the two parties being four parties under the hood. And in the New Deal coalition and through the 1970s, the parties overlapped. There were people who are conservative in each party. And when bills had to be passed, it went through a decentralized Congress where people and committees worked together from both sides. People knew which party controlled Congress, both the House and the Senate. The Democrats did. And throughout our history, we've had periods of what are called sun parties, where a party is dominated, and moon parties that have followed that party and negotiated with them. And we had such a case during the New Deal. And the New Deal framework, in terms of what government did, was accepted. Eisenhower accepted it. Now, there were people under the hood, activists in the Republican Party, who didn't, but Eisenhower did. And so the leadership did, and so everyone could work together. Legislating was bipartisan. When the Democrats passed civil rights, identity politics began to take root, because even though civil rights itself was popular, the enforcement through busing, affirmative action, et cetera, in a time of increasingly tense economic times in the 70s, when we had the first factory closings, when wages were starting to stagnate, became tough.
When I go back to reflecting what happened in prior decades, in the last century, we still had that sort of thing. We had groups that were anti-slavery, the abolitionists, and you had the Whig Party, which you had the Republican Party, which grew out of the Whig Party. You had the Democrats from the North, the Democrats from the South, and literally different parties with different in 1860 different presidential candidates, and as I recall, Lincoln did not win a majority of all the votes when you put it together, when you took the whole package together, that he happened to win more than the other parties and gave him the Electoral College victory, which is an ironic thing, because what would we have done without Lincoln? And what would we have done without the Electoral College?
Yeah, and so those are, you know, that's so true, and it and as you look at the fracture in the 1800s before the Civil War, you know, all those parties had to accommodate pro-slavery and anti-slavery out, you know, until ultimately they didn't, and then we got to, you know, the Republican Party, and it won because it only had a sliver in the North, but there were divided election. But yeah, those parties and our legislative efforts succeeded because you had conservative in terms of civil rights and liberal interests all in the same party, and everyone had to negotiate.
We're coming up to time where we have to take a break, but I want to set the table for a further discussion on a slightly different point. For, in my view, ever since Watergate, there has been in the legislature and then in the people a drift against the concept of compromise. And with the people who saw what happened in Watergate and were unhappy with it, by the way, for those of you under a certain age, or it was brutal, and it was a lot of corruption which occurred during the presidency of Richard Nixon. But the group that came in afterwards basically had a cynicism about government, and it was reinforced on both sides. Both sides had this cynicism towards government in different ways. And we had the rise the rise of the political journalists, epitomized by the two Washington reporters, Woodward and Bernstein, Washington Post reporters. But when they got in, if you deviated from a particular position that somebody or a group thought was morally perfect, then you were condemned. And this goes on both sides of the divide. The concept of compromise, which did get us through a lot of our history, was further and further being pushed out by quote unquote principle, which meant I'm not going to compromise with you until you adopt everything that I want. At any rate, that's my thought. And we're going to take a break right now. We're talking to Bill Hurst, the author of Our Great Political Divide. And he and I have been talking about the status of our country. We accept the fact that people are divided now. But we're probing whether or not this is unique to our time. Why has it happened? Where is it going? What's wrong with it is what we're going to be talking about now. So we're going to take a break right now. This is John Smetanka on With Respect, and we will be right back. Now back on With Respect with our guest, Bill Hurst. Bill is the author of Our Great Political Divide, talking about the split in the American population, both from the liberal conservative side, the various other groupings that we have, and how we got where we are and where we're going. And I tossed out the concept of the unpleasantness about compromise for many years has been a dirty word, very ungood. There's somebody is compromising a principle.
So it's a good observation that you made, John, that in the 70s was when compromise started to become a little less acceptable. And here we need to look at how the parties became programmatic and organized, and how in the 1970s, the Democrats and Republicans nationalized their party platforms, their fundraising, their organization in Congress, to where people who thought differently than the leadership had less and less say. And in the 80s, as the Senate and the Republican became 50-50 institutions where they could change hands to either party, in any election, the incentives to compromise, and political scientists have measured this, became such that the minorities actually didn't want to compromise, and they became intransigent. They started introducing amendments that were more about messaging and bills that were more about messaging to get people on the record about things they didn't like, and they wouldn't cooperate with a majority, whereas in the New Deal, they would cooperate and make legislation. And in fact, the leadership would say, you cannot cooperate. One other thing that you mentioned about, compromise becoming a dirty word, we need to look at our culture. And our culture has become more ironic, a little less accepting of, straightforward talk, et cetera. And, that's a factor as well.
Where do you see this in the social or economic field? We've been talking about politics, but you in your book talk about those other areas too.
Well, I think that, people say that when you look at, and political science have looked at the rise of Trump, and as I mentioned, when I first began talking to folks, I thought, this is about economics. This is about people feeling that they're left behind. But the studies have shown that it's that people look at the economics through identity, the eyes of identity politics. And so they look at their communities and what's happened to them economically, not necessarily that they themselves are suffering economically. And so when we look at the 2008 recession and the fact that, you know, cities, you know, they're in dynamic technological, you know, technology industries have done well, but maybe the heartland hasn't done as well and hasn't come back, opioids have become, you know, so it's such an incredible issue in some areas. You know, the health of the, you know, of the general populace has not really been great economically. I think economics plays a role, but it's sort of in the background. It's still the second fiddle to identity politics, but it probably propels identity politics to a great extent.
What effect does religion have in all this? You mentioned it earlier, and it tangentially came up with the Roe v. Wade and abortion. But it also fits in other areas, doesn't it?
Yeah. So, you know, religion is the idea. It is for some folks a bedrock, and it's part of their set of values, as opposed to trying to create a whole new set of values for yourself, you know, on the liberal identity end of things. We talk about college students today figuring out what gender they are. That is certainly in many ways not a religious way of looking at things, where folks who are religious, you know, come to the debate or their worldview. You know, and so that's another good point. Our politics today are about worldview. Religion is part of that worldview. And so when you're more traditional, you believe in place, children, family, et cetera, as opposed to being the individual and, you know, in a finding your own way in the world, et cetera. That's a big difference in worldview. So religion is just part of that worldview, but it's a big piece.
And the organized religions and the... If there is such, I'm not sure how you can describe an organized non-religious or anti-religious group, but I'm sure I know there are people out there who organize because they think that religion is evil and it's destroying people's lives and ingenuity and whatever else in their thinking. But to the extent that they became involved in politics, these people on both sides take religion as fighting words or as this marks you. This is one of those major marks in your soul that, you know, you can never change. If you happen to be religious and I happen to be not religious, you look on that as a deep flaw that I can't even talk to you. And the same thing goes the other way. It's a fascinating thing, not pleasant if you're on either side of the divide, but it is a fascinating phenomenon.
Well, we really need to bridge the gap, and so there are so many groups, and not regard, you know, just pure religion, whether you're religious or not, you know, as a political dividing line. We've politicized so much of our lives. People, you know, have the right, in my view, you know, to have their faith, to believe, you know, in religion. It gives certainly continuity to communities that might not have it otherwise. So religion, you know, can be a real force for good. I think what we've seen in the United States, though, you know, in some cases, is that religion has become, you know, a way for people on the right, in some cases, to battle for control of the overall agenda in our country. So, you know, I think that it used to be that religion was not that dividing line when pretty much the whole country was religious in the 60s and 50s, except for a small sliver. And it's too bad now that religion has become that dividing line and a marker. You know, there are a lot of groups on the reform side of things that try and have kitchen table conversations. Braver Angels is one group, you know, and certainly trying to get past these cultural issues is very, very important for our politics, for the health of our politics. I mean, we're trying to solve problems, not symbolic arguments. And so a lot of our arguments have become symbolic. I mean, honestly, in many cases, religion has nothing to do with much of the policy that's created. And we're simply arguing along the edges culturally about things that don't really affect certain issues. There are a lot of issues that don't necessarily need to have religion involved in them.
There's also another area which you mentioned earlier. Right at the beginning, you talked about the concept of place, and that place is a factor in the quote the divide. And I put to you that have we too much gotten into the difference between the great flyover, which is the Midwest, everything between the mountains, and the East and West Coast, and to some other extent, major cities elsewhere. But certainly that's the one that comes to mind the most. And I, you know, the ironic thing is I have seen that in reality, and people who are from different parts of the country have no conception whatsoever of how the world functions in the Great Flyover or in the coasts. I mean, I could talk about images and slang descriptions, but I don't have to do that because everybody has them in their own mind. Are you a coastie or are you a farmer? And I remember a friend of mine came from California, went to school here in the Midwest, and when she came to Midwest to go to a university here, she was told by her friends, why are you going to Indiana? I mean, they said they're all cows there. And so she came in with this bias against the very area she was coming into. After 3 years, I talked to her and I said, so what do you think? She said, I learned something. I learned that in the West Coast, we don't make friends as deeply as they do in the Midwest. That is, if you're a friend in the Midwest, it may go three generations of families together. It may go not just people's politics, but their whole being a part of a community, a solid community that at least perceive it's a solid community. Now, it may not be in reality, but that's how they perceive it.
Well, yeah, and so people have talked about this phrase is great, the somewheres versus the anywheres. And anywheres being, those folks who could live anywhere who tend to be more coastal and global and cosmopolitan, and the somewheres meaning people who have that sense of place, those deep roots. And you can see the appeal of deep roots. That's why, we talked about the fact that the differences between the parties, in politics has become a worldview-oriented difference, not just about policy. And so when we talk about worldview, we're talking about all these cultural differences. But there is something to be said for patriotism, for love of country, for all those things that hold society together. And I think liberals need to be cognizant that their morality, which tends to stress fairness, et cetera, and probably may not involve as deep connections with other people, as friends and in society and through the church, et cetera, they need to be aware of those connections and how important they are to so many people.
I teach American law and culture over in Europe, in the Czech Republic and in Slovakia every year since about 2001. And one of the things that I was struck by is so many of the people that I was teaching, these are all young lawyers and older lawyers and judges, and when they talk about America, they have all different kinds of views, and they change. They're not monolithic in their ideas about America, but they do tend to say, how do you Americans fit in our constellation? And the first thing they say is, you're so patriotic. You are so patriotic. The flag means something, and your country means something to you on a deep personal level. And, of course, we see the conflict these days between those people who see the flag as an emblem of history of goodness, of struggle to achieve something positive. And then on the other side, you see the flag is emblematic of failures that we have had in slavery or inequity in our society. And so it's an interesting thing. From the outside, people look at this as a hallmark of the Americans. Another one, ironically, is they tell me, you're different than we are in organized charity. And that is, you guys believe in giving private funds to solve problems and to get involved in society. And now this is an exaggeration, but we don't. With us, it's government. Which reminds me of a book that I dearly love, which is Democracy in America by de Tocqueville, in which he talks about the head of his chapter, one chapter is about this very issue. And he said, in America, if there is a social problem, people will automatically start to form organizations. If it's alcohol, we have the Christian Temperance Union and so on, to solve these problems, and that we're problem-solving sorts of people, pragmatic. And we look at that in the economy, in our economy as well. But at any rate, I want to, unfortunately, we have to take a break right now, but when we come back, I'd like you to kind of reflect on some of those character traits that kind of still split. You know, they can be on both sides of the equation. This is John Smetanka, Run With Respect, and we're talking to Bill Hurst, the author of Our Great Political Divide, about America right now and maybe in the past, and where are we going in the future. This is John Smetanka. We'll be right back. Back and with respect with Bill Hurst. Bill is the author of Our Great Political Divide, and it's a fascinating deep dive into statistics and history and thought and interviews and just a fascinating book. This is John Smetanka. So, Bill, when I broke, take it away.
Yeah, so you mentioned Tocqueville. And his observation that Americans would form societies and groups to solve problems in their community. And this is something that people like Robert Putnam have observed in Bowling Alone. We don't do as much as we used to. And it's something we really have lost. And we've lost it especially among folks in communities that aren't quite as vibrant and often, you know, fly-by communities, the fly-by rust belt, you know, maybe some towns that are not as prosperous or dynamic as they used to be. So we need to really look at those, at the fabric of our society. You know, and as I talk about and look at reforms, I don't see that just mechanical political reforms are what we need, but I think that we need more glue in our society to bring people together, you know, and what those proposals would be to do it or how we do it privately or publicly, you know, is a subject that, you know, is difficult. But I think your observation about, you know, about what Tocqueville said is very, very important because people have seen that we don't have it as much as we used to. A lot of it, you know, comes down to whether we have social capital, whether people trust their government. You know, and we saw in the pandemic, the trust of society and government has gone down dramatically. Trust is a very important word. Societies that have trust can operate to solve problems together, either privately or publicly, and, you know, Scandinavian countries will do it publicly, but they are successful because there's such trust. In the United States, we've lost trust, not just in the government, but in a lot of cases in each other. And that's a big problem.
One of the things that is interesting about this book of yours, and we could talk all day long about the various aspects of your observations for the origin of these problems and the status of the problems, and also about where we're going. But I do want to take some time to say that if people read this book, they're going to see in great detail the ways that he came upon his many of his observations, and included deep dives and interviews and people, as well as statistics, and well as looking at the writers of the past. So how did you go about this book, Bill?
Yeah, so let's talk about those interviews and also some of the observations that I had from those interviews. So I interviewed about a small group of people, a handful, maybe about more than a handful, maybe about 20 people. And I interviewed them, filmed them. I even have a number of these interviews that are out on the internet. If you buy the book, you'll see where they are. But basically, I wanted to talk to people in depth. And so I talked to people for an hour and a half, 2 hours, in some cases more than once, with people from both sides of the divide. And, you know, I found some observations that really gave me kind of hope, gave me some hope. You know, so we talk about how divided we are. But, you know, when I talk to conservatives, for example, people who generally supported Trump, actually they all supported Trump, they had, the conservatives, they had fluid policies. It's not as if that we were really divided on policy. They didn't raise, for example, deficit concerns. They didn't think government should be shrunk. They thought their Social Security and Medicare should be protected. They were not free trade oriented. I mean, actually, some of these things are things I am, even though I'm a liberal, you know, a little more on the centrist side of things. They were okay with immigration, which really was a surprise to me. I thought they would parrot, you know, what Donald Trump has said about immigration. On the other hand, those folks were also very, very suspicious of government. But, you know, I know a lot of these folks who I interviewed. They're really good people. You know, so these are some folks who, if you were in trouble yourself and that you were a neighbor, they would give you the shirt off their back. But they had a lot of suspicion of government. They thought that politicians were uncaring, that they lied. I would push back on both liberals and conservatives who I interviewed. And I'd say to the conservatives, well, Donald Trump, you know, often doesn't tell the truth. And they'd basically say, well, all politicians lie. But they were, while they didn't think that government needed to be reduced, they were suspicious of programs that give it all away to groups and specific groups and not to the general population. You know, they felt that there could be groups that didn't necessarily, you know, deserve it. And they had some lack of trust. They had a lot of lack of trust of mainstream media. In some cases, they didn't really know what to think, you know, and where to get their information. And we would talk about that. That is what leaves them susceptible to conspiracy theories. Now, on the liberal side, the folks I interviewed were a little more programmatic. You could tell that they were readers of papers like the New York Times, et cetera. They were a little more buttoned up in that respect. They were not, didn't have maybe quite as much. They had a lot of variation from each other. Some thought that society should be completely open, that we should let immigrants in. Others recognize the need for, you know, for hard borders, et cetera, and for more border security. But I think the liberals were a little more programmatic. Now, what worried me a little bit about the liberals were that they, like the Democratic Party, wanted to see a lot bigger government. They were not necessarily concerned about how it would be paid for, you know, and for me as a little more of a blue dog Democrat, I was very concerned about that lack of operational detail, you know, in their views.
Where do we go now? I know that you're going to be writing a new book, and I hope that it's is the catalyst to change America. But realistically, I'm hoping it's going to be part of a struggle. What is your view on how this gets straightened out?
Yeah. So the book I wrote, if you know, as readers will find out, you know, talks about some very deep fault lines. So I don't want to promise, you know, false optimism about how we get out of where we're at, nor in this new book, which is going to be about political reform. One of the things I want to do is examine some of the ideas that some people put forth in a lot more detail, like preventing gerrymandering. What will it do? What won't it do? Ranked choice voting, open primaries. These are some ideas that people put forth. Let's talk about an open primary. Right now in our system, people and Republicans often are afraid, and Democrats are afraid of getting primaried out where someone more extreme, because individual activists within parties tend to be a little more extreme, will vote them out of office because they're centrists. And so that leads to people who are less willing to compromise. The reforms I want to look at are those that will bring in people who are more willing to compromise. People, for example, talk about ranked choice voting and its tendency, and what ranked choice voting is. It means that you vote not just for your top candidate, but you rank your order choice among a number of candidates. And then if your top choice doesn't get, is last in the tally, your votes go to your second choice, and you keep going until someone gets a plurality, gets 50% of the vote. That tends to make people a little less extreme, because they know they need not just your top choice necessarily if it's them, but they need to, a Donald Trump, for example, would need to be aware that he may need the second choice vote of a number of people, the third choice vote of a number of people. So he would be less apt to criticize people quite as harshly as he does, for example. That's how ranked choice voting might work. It also allows for more competition in our system, because we could have third parties and you wouldn't be throwing away your vote like you do in a two-party system when you vote for somebody who's in a third party and they basically, it's a spoiler, you know, where your vote simply doesn't count in that case. So these are the kind of reforms I'm looking at, but I'm also really trying to get at the roots philosophically of why we're so divided still, in terms of what reforms and what civic education, what way of looking at things could bring us closer together.
What is the degree that I have clients who say to me, John, come on, I need a percentage of the chance of success in this case. And I tell them, there are too many variables. I cannot give you a percentage. Your chances of winning are 62%. And your chances of losing are 38%. I mean, that's what they want. But I'm going to ask you, what do you think are the percentages of the chance of success of some of your ideas?
Oh, boy, John. Well, I think...
You don't want to do it, do you?
I think that immediately, we are in a crisis. I mean, the crisis is that, for example... in 2024, we could have a deadlock in our election, and with parties now in the states being able to overturn those states, if that had happened in the 2020 election, we could potentially have been deadlocked, and we don't have a good set of laws for Congress to handle that kind of deadlock. So I would say we need a really big crisis. That could be, for example, an election, like in 2024, if it becomes deadlocked. But I would say without it, our chances are pretty slim for a lot of these reforms. I'm going to say 20% if you need 25% if you need a percentage. But I would say once we have a crisis, it's either we have reform, and then the chances go up to 60% that the reforms are put in place, some reforms that moderate and get people together, or we go to a system of government that's less than democratic.
Well, I'm going to suggest there is our earlier friend I talked about, Lynn Olson, in her book on the run-up on the American side of the ocean to the Second World War. It was a country divided, hatred, rioting, not only the Depression, but rather many, many different issues divided us. And especially isolation. Our country was split down the center. Guess what? One thing intervened an outside enemy, Pearl Harbor. And all of a sudden, everybody joined together. Now, I'm going to take a risk here, and I'm going to say that if there was that sort of an issue, you talked about the 2024 election. I don't even know what that event would be, or that condition that mobilized an outside enemy, if you will, a threat from the outside, and would bring us all together again. And just like in 2001, when the Twin Towers and the Pentagon were bombed and the plane landed in the fields of Pennsylvania, four planes changed the nation. And for better or worse, changed the nation. But it united everybody for a short period of time. When George H.W. Bush was president and we won the operation, I can't remember right now, where we got Kuwait back.
Desert Storm,
thank you. When Desert Storm came along, he had 95% approval. And then it crashed because we no longer had the outside foe, the joint effort that put everybody together as one for a period of time. Unfortunately, I have to have the last word only because we've run out of time. Bill Hurst has been our guest. He's written the book, Our Great Political Divide. Buy it. It's a fascinating book. Or maybe you can find it in the library or whatever. Whatever you find it, take a look at it. It's a good book. This is John Smetanka. We're on With Respect. And we want to thank Bill Hurst for joining us. Remember, we're on every Sunday and Thursday. And our motto is, if you show respect to other people, they will show respect to you.